Love Bristol. Love BCFM 93.2.
When Rudolf Hess flew to Scotland, Ian Fleming, then an intelligence officer and yet to become the creator of a series of Hitlerian villains, suggested that the only man to interview Hess was Aleister Crowley, the black magician and sometime initiate of the Order of the Golden Dawn, whose salute the Nazis had borrowed. Fleming was thus among the first to acknowledge that the Nazi government was an occult organization. You have to imagine an entire nation taken over by Jim Jones or David Koresh or Luke Jure. Imagine the United States of America, in which everyone is a member of the Ku Klux Klan.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. It happened in Tehran in 1981. How would you like it if the US blew up your president and the entire cabinet? ...17,000 victims of terrorism in Iran since the 1979 revolution. We hear from the wife of one of them this evening. Her physicist professor husband was killed 5 years ago on his morning drive to work by a bomb detonated by remote control just as the car was passing. Plus, the strange case of Raymond Davis, the US defence contractor in Lahore, Pakistan, who got suspicious that two men were following him, so he turned round and shot them dead. Obama said he was a US diplomat, but after Pakistani police arrested him on his phone, it became clear he was in touch with the terror groups in Afghanistan and Pakistan, supplying them with weapons. So just what is the role of private defence contractors? Where do they get their orders? And where do they get our money? And why do we hear so little about them? We speak to Professor of International Relations at the University of Peshawar, Saeed Shaheed. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. But first, I'm pleased to welcome back Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth. Hi, Mike.
Hello there.
Let's start with fracking first, because this is one thing that worries me. When it comes to turning on my tap, my first worry is usually Bristol Water, who are the worst water company in the country, according to Ofcom, massively overcharging everybody and taking legal action when... Ofwat try to get them to charge us the right price. They set the lawyers on Ofwat. But then my second thought is, what about the quality and the content of the water? Because a lot of this water comes from the Mendips, which is where the fracking could potentially take place. So what's the latest?
Oh, things have moved on a lot, Tony. There were areas of the Mendips that were earmarked for fracking, but actually some of the companies that, or the company that was involved in those areas, has actually handed its license back, and that seems to have quietened down. But the government now wants to unleash a sort of fracking blitz on whole new areas of the West Country. So they've opened up, or they plan to license for oil and gas companies, four big blocks of land in Gloucestershire, Somerset, Wiltshire and Dorset. You mentioned water. The area in Gloucestershire covers most of the Forest of Dean, but it also covers Sharpness, which is where the canal goes down by the Severn, which is actually where we get our drinking water from in North Bristol.
The whole business of fracking and shale, can you just explain some of these terms? Because I know there are all sorts of nasty consequences of these things, and one does wonder if it's all just some way to make someone's kind of get rich quick scheme, which certainly seems to have transpired in the United States, and actually there's some doubts over whether people are even getting rich. They're certainly destroying the environment and our drinking water. But what is shale and what is fracking?
Okay, well, the areas that they're looking at, it's a bit unclear what they would intend to do. We don't actually know at this point, because what the government does is it, it draws a line on a map, it sells the rights to a particular company. They have the exclusive rights to any oil and gas they get out of the ground in that area. And we don't, it doesn't specify what kind of technology they might use. So there are a lot of coal seams, obviously, underneath the ground in the east of Bristol, the Forest of Dean, over in Mendip. These are all former mining areas. Those coal seams may still contain gas. And there is there are technologies called coal bed methane, which enable companies to get that gas out, but at the cost of a risk of a major contamination of the water environment. Below that lies the shale, which is a rock formation which also contains gas, but in order to get it out, the companies have to drill down and then they have to force water, chemicals and sand, a mixture at immensely high pressure, into the rocks to fracture them. That's what the fracking acronym, the fracking name means. It's fracturing the rocks, letting the gas out. Now, our concern is that in order to do that, they have to, in some instances, and the new license blocks that they're looking at in Wiltshire and Gloucestershire, certainly, they would be drilling potentially through the drinking water, through the groundwater aquifers, to get to the rocks underneath. And there is good evidence now from the fracking industry in the States that there are documented records of instances where fracking below the drinking water aquifer has contaminated the water. So once the fracking has happened, it's not a process that is very easy for the engineers to control. They don't know where the fractures are going to open up. They can't totally dictate which direction the gas flows in. They can't be certain that the well that they've drilled to access the strata way down below the earth, maybe 2-3 kilometers down, will be sound all that way down. There might be cracks as the rocks deform and move. Cracks might happen in the well. So there are many potential ways by which both the gas itself and the fluids that are pumped down and come back up from the wells could end up contaminating our drinking water.
Well, this has been going on in the United States for a long time. What's been the experience over there?
Well, not good, but it's been very difficult to find out exactly what the implications have been. It's a poorly understood area, and because the states wanted to, the federal government wanted to sort of encourage as much fracking to happen as quickly as possible, they essentially stripped away a whole lot of water protection legislation, which meant that the companies weren't under any obligation to monitor either before or after they did the fracking. So
yeah, but I mean, if people aren't keeling over and dying, then surely this is okay.
Well, keeling over and dying is a sort of rather extreme way of putting it. What is happening is that people are finding that the drinking water wells which they rely on are becoming contaminated to the extent that they are not fit for them for human consumption.
The other thing is quite a lot going on in the world of solar. I mean, one of the big things that came in with the coalition government when they came in 2010 was they started reining back solar subsidies. Yet I still see, when you go around the country, you still see these kind of solar farms where the sheep are kind of looking across from the nearby field saying, hang on, that used to be our field. It's now covered with solar panels.
Well, The big story now with solar is that the government wants to drastically slash the feed-in tariff, which is the mechanism they've introduced, which has encouraged householders, community organisations to install solar on buildings. So the government said, we don't like having solar in fields. This was a statement that was made back in the days of the coalition government. They said that they were worried that too much land was going under solar farms. When they were then asked, well, how much land was going underneath solar farms, they didn't know. So they hadn't actually collected the statistics. They just wanted to to curtail that industry. But they said it's all fine to put it on rooftops instead. But now they're cutting by nearly 90%. They plan to cut by nearly 90% the incentive that encourages people to fit solar panels on their roofs, on roofs of community buildings. This will have a devastating effect potentially on the industry. There are, in the southwest, we think 13,000 people get their jobs from the solar industry. Those jobs will be at risk. There are all also a very large number of community energy projects, something like 250 community energy projects going around the country, which enable, around the southwest, I should say, which enable communities to take a stake in generating energy in their own areas. And these too are dependent on the same mechanism, the solar feed-in tariff that the government intends to cut back by anything up to 90%. So we're worried that a very promising, clean industry that has the potential to generate a lot of our energy in future is now going to be kicked out of play for many years to come.
Now, Mike, I'm not sure if you know the figures, but I know Bristol's got one of the highest tidal reaches of any port in the world.
It has.
The water comes in, and do you know the figures? How much the water goes up?
I think it's about 14 metres or 45 feet is the extreme tidal range, which is sort of somewhere near Portishead.
Yeah, so we've got an amazing potential there for to generate power through tidal power, effectively, isn't it? And I mean, this is the idea of the amount of water flowing in and out of the Severn Gorge, for example, could be. You could have a couple of turbines there, since we don't seem to get so many tea clippers or opium clippers in and out of the gorge anymore. That would be a potential way of generating a lot of electricity for the city. Why hasn't it happened before now?
There's a scheme which has now got its planning consent. It hasn't yet agreed a subsidy deal with the government for a tidal lagoon in Swansea Bay, and this is a wall is built out, a sort of semicircular wall built out from the seafront, and it would collect the water when the tide comes in and then release it through turbines and generate water.
But we wouldn't need a tidal lagoon in Bristol, would we? We've already got one. It's called the River Avon, and it would flow backwards and forwards.
It would be a fairly limited amount compared to what you could generate from these big tidal lagoons. So the company behind that is now talking about following that up with anything up to another three big tidal lagoons, two of them on the Welsh side of the estuary over by Newport, and one potentially in Bridgewater Bay. Potentially these are schemes which generate a massive amount of electricity, but they also do raise concerns about how much effect they would have on the Severn Estuary itself, which an area of extreme importance for its nature.
And the barrage, is that dead?
At the moment, the barrage idea of putting a wall between Cardiff and Weston, that is pretty much dead. It was a non-starter economically. It would create immense amount of environmental damage. It was opposed by the Bristol Port, who were very worried that it would impede the flow of shipping to and from the port.
Maybe they've got shares in the Severn Crossing, because they seem to massively overcharge, and it's a potential to have another crossing that's actually generating electricity. Might be an interesting way of looking at things.
Well, imagine the cost that you would have to charge, what you would have to charge somebody to recoup the cost on a Severn barrage would make the Severn bridge look pretty insignificant.
Well, apparently they've paid for it tens of times over the Severn bridge, so you know, there's a potential there anyway to make a few bob, as the Severn bridge people have done. How many times do we have to pay for the Severn bridge before they say, okay, you can travel over it for nothing?
Well,
an open question. Anyway, what about Hinkley? What's the latest there? I think it's interesting that George Osborne has been over in China this week. I wonder if the Chinese are looking rather sceptically at him, even narrower than normal through their eyes. What is this guy up to? Because he's saying, we were inviting tenders for HS2 before it's even gone through Parliament. Now, they've been invited. Osborne was inviting tenders for the Hinkley C power station as well. And the Chinese are now saying, well, hang on a minute. What's happening with that?
Yeah, it's a strategy of desperation now from Osborne, because the British backers pulled out of the Hinkley C project. There's no work going on there at the moment. It's a kind of reactor that of which there are two other examples in Europe, both of them running massively over budget and massively behind schedule. There's even talk that the French one at Flamanville in Normandy may have to be abandoned altogether.
Hang on, Mike. You're an environmentalist. You can't abandon a nuclear power station. It's quite radioactive.
Before it's not been built. It's not been finished. There's no fuel in it.
Abandoned before
they even start it up.
Maybe it could be a kind of ruin of the power station that never was. Martin, the economics of this is pretty appalling, isn't it?
Well, nuclear power has never really been viable in a free market sense. I remember in the 80s when they were talking about privatising nuclear power, I had to write a paper for NEF, New Economics Foundation, and the City of London at first were slavering at the mouth, saying, oh, well, we're going to take over nuclear power. And as soon as they looked at the figures, they said, oh, no, we're not interested. And I think it's only because of government intervention that nuclear power exists.
Nikki Clark from Stop Hinkley talks about it as a bomb factory. In fact, even the existing Hinkley power stations producing plutonium and producing uranium.
I think that's a lot of the explanation of why you have nuclear power stations around the world.
So is it a bomb factory?
Basically, the plutonium you need to make bombs is produced by civilian nuclear power. And that's why all the fuss has been made about Iran's nuclear power, whatever side of that argument you're on.
There's an award-winning film going around at the moment. In fact, it's being shown this weekend. It's called High Power. It won on a film at the Uranium Film Festival in 2013. Tarapur Nuclear Power Station, the first nuclear power plant in India, was set up 40 years ago with much fanfare, displacing villages near the town named Tarapur, the town that gives its name to the plant. It's, however, miles away from the dream it had promised to be. What really happened there in those 40 long years is awaiting the whole world. Awakening the whole world needs to arrive at before it's too late. Once a protagonist, he visits these villages. He observes the situation of thousands of displaced people that he finds. And this film, High Power, is going to be shown in Bristol this Sunday at the Eastern Community Centre. I think that starts around about 7 p.m. Eastern Community Centre, Kilburn Street in Eastern, BS56AW. And on Monday, it'll be at the Truth Out Cinema at the Art House, 108A Stokescroft, BS1. And so that film is about the Indian experience, Mike, on the ground of nuclear power. What about here? Are we going to see this in Hinkley C? Is it going to be built or not?
I would, if I was going to bet on it, I would bet more on it actually being built than it ever actually being fueled up and started.
So it might look like the French one.
It might get that far, yes. So to go back to Osborne and China, which you were asking me about, the government has been so desperate now to get backers for it that they're making ever more extravagant promises to the Chinese state nuclear industry. About they're saying that they will guarantee cost overruns to the tune of £2 billion from the British taxpayer to a Chinese state-owned corporation to come and take a stake and build it for us. But they're also saying that they want to give the Chinese the right to come and build and operate nuclear power stations on the Essex coast. So the sweeteners they are now chucking in the direction of China are getting ever more extravagant for the sake of completing what is now looking like being the most expensive power station in the world.
Well, it's amazing, isn't it? And you have to look at some of the reasons or question why it is that there's this obsession with keeping these power stations going when they cost so much, and it may have more than we think, according to Nikki Clark from Stop Hinkley, to do with plutonium. So let's have a listen to
The nuclear power stations, the first generations of nuclear power stations that we ever had in this country, were designed for maximising the yield of plutonium for military purposes. They probably have enough of a stockpile.
That's the Magnox ones.
That's the Magnox ones, yes, like we used to have at Barclay on the 7.
So that's Hinkley A, is it?
And Hinkley A, indeed, yes, yeah. Yes. And I would imagine that the stockpile they've already got of plutonium from those reactors is kind of enough.
Well, anyway, that's what a lot of people think, but Nikki puts us straight on this.
Let me just say something about plutonium, because this was a real shock to me when I discovered this, because the half-life of plutonium-239, which is what they tend to use in the big A-bombs, hydrogen bombs, the half-life is 24,000 years. Now, the government talks about the plutonium stocks and all the plutonium we've got at Sellafield. So everybody thinks that we've got enough plutonium. Why would we ever need to make any more? And what I learned when I got involved with researching and learning for myself about these issues is, although it has a half-life of 24,000 years, it has a shelf life in terms of being usable in a nuclear weapon of just about 2 or 3 years. So contrary to popular belief amongst us as lay people, where we think, oh God, there's loads of plutonium, it lasts forever, why would you need any more? They actually have to keep making fresh plutonium, because after 2 or 3 years, enough of the plutonium has decayed that it's not going to perform properly if they drop that bomb. So they have to take the plutonium out of the bomb and replace it with new plutonium. So I want to explain why the government always have a reason for making more plutonium.
Not much good if you drop a hydrogen bomb, Martin, is it? And it goes fizzle pop and nothing much happens.
Well, it opens the interesting possibility that the Chinese may demand that they can have the plutonium from Hinkley for their bombs as part of the deal.
So, that was Nikki Clark from Stop Hinkley. Just a reminder about that film. It's called... High Power, and it won the Uranium Film Festival Award, the Uranium Film Festival Award in 2013. It's going to be shown on Bristol here on the Eastern Community Centre on Sunday evening. That's in Kilburn Street, BS5. And on Monday, you can catch it too at the Truth Out Cinema at the Art House, 108A Stokescroft. BS1. But before you go, Mike, I'd like to have a chat with you a little bit about this Volkswagen story, because this is something which has hit this week.
Yeah.
And what they've been doing apparently with the software in these cars, and it doesn't surprise me, this sort of thing, because of course, you know, anyone can tweak something in the software. If you haven't actually got access directly to the source code of that software, you can make it do almost whatever you want, can't you? As we've found here.
Well, yeah, and we've known for some years that the supposed tightening of emission standards for cars has not led to cleaner air on the streets. It just doesn't seem to have been following in the way it should have done. And we always kind of knew that there was a difference between the way that a car would perform when you put it on a test bed and the way that it would perform in the real world. But the lengths that the manufacturers, in this case Volkswagen, have gone to deceive the legislators, I think have been a real eye-opener.
And the public,
absolutely,
of course.
Of course, to deceive us, the public, via the legislator. But it's not an unimportant issue. We now think that air pollution in the streets, in the cities and towns of Britain, is the biggest public health problem that we face after active smoking. So active smoking is the only thing that is worse than air pollution, mostly from vehicles.
Well, I think you and I'd agree that that cars, in fact most car users would probably agree, that they're rather a plague, because as soon as you need to use it, you usually find there's thousands of other people that want to use their car at exactly the same time, so you have to sit in a jam for far too long, and also it's much nicer, isn't it, to be able to put your feet up and go on the train. But all the train prices seems to be fixed to be just a little bit more than it would cost you if you were to use petrol. I mean, I've done quite a lot of research into this over the years, and you can find, if you want, my article about Dr. Beeching and the close down of the railways in the 1960s on the Russia Today website. If you want to have a look at that, rt.com, and just search for Beeching, you should find that. And Martin, the oil industry over the years have had a massive amount of influence, but now we're hearing that these German car companies, and it doesn't look like Volkswagen is the only one either, have been deliberately fixing these emission tests. Now that has a big knock-on effect on their sales, and also it's not the first time, because just a few weeks ago we had a story which was The Independent broke, where it showed that organised crime had long ago cracked the security systems that allow you to get into and out of your car, in other words, to lock it and unlock it. And the researchers in Britain that had were trying to expose this, what Volkswagen did is they set the lawyers on them, and they said, you're not allowed to speak about this to anybody. And it was literally only on Tuesday the 18th of August that anyone was allowed to talk about this. So organised crime knew all about how to get into a Volkswagen, but none of the dealers or the customers of Volkswagen knew anything about it. It almost seems like these big corporations are some sort of having legal battles with us.
Well, I mean, they are beyond the law, or they try to be beyond the law. I mean, that's one of the problems with the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Agreement. It's going to actually give these corporations more power than they've already got.
So I suppose what we're hinting at here is that if, say, for example, the United States wants to sue Volkswagen in a case like this, that Volkswagen will have some heavier rights to sue the United States government back.
Well, yes, and it may also to be do with geopolitics, because Germany and Germany and the US are now diverging on issues like Ukraine and Syria, and it may be that they've known about this all along, and it comes out now because they want to put pressure on the Germans in relation to geopolitical matters. But I think the fact that one of the problems with all of this new technology is it's all hackable, whether it's a drone or a car, and the idea
or an airliner,
and so you know the suspicion that Michael Hastings, an investigative journalist in the US, had his car hacked and then it was driven into a wall at high speed even though he was trying to stop it. And I think the more of this kind of IT you have in transportation, like cars and planes and so on, in actual fact the more vulnerable you potentially are. And the Iranians, for example, managed to hack into a drone that was flying into over Iran and make it land in Iran. What would happen if they were able to hack into all the drones that were flying towards Iran and make them send them instructions to fire, you know, to turn back and blow up where they've been launched from? This kind of thing, it makes all of these technologies are actually double-edged.
There's loads of Volkswagen employees have been suspended because of the share price going down. Also, they're going to have to be reining back production on Volkswagens. Call me cynical, but I wonder if this isn't partly an excuse, because actually people aren't buying so many cars now.
Well, as I've just indicated, that there may be geopolitical aspects to the timing of this revelation. I'm not saying that there are, but it's certainly been suggested in things that I've read. Because, you know, there's an awful lot of industrial espionage goes on, and you know, you hold it back until it's suitable to use. And I don't think it's just Volkswagen who are involved in this. I'm pretty sure that other companies have been involved in a similar way.
Well, certainly many other car companies, mostly German ones on the list on the Independent article, were involved in that other scandal. But Mike, what I suppose this tells us is that cars aren't just killing people through pollution. They're also run by crooks.
Well, they're run by companies that are taking an attitude towards environmental legislation that is pretty reprehensible. You were mentioning earlier on about people having to sit in traffic jams. Of course, it's the car driver and the passenger, but especially the driver, is the person who's most vulnerable to the air pollution caused by vehicles. They spend more time sitting in it than anybody else.
I mean, how do the oil companies manage to wrangle it so that the rail fares are so expensive? I mean, that seems to be amazing, really.
You can certainly look at the trend over the past couple of decades of the cost, the real cost of public transport fares, and contrast that with the real cost of motoring, and see that whereas motoring in real terms has flatlined or slightly come down, the cost of public transport fares has continually risen. So the gap between public transport and driving has actually got substantially worse over the last 20 years.
Yes, it's privatisation mainly. What about Bristol? How do we stand as a city, congestion wise and pollution wise, Mike?
Congestion wise, we are pretty near the bottom of the league table. We're one of the most congested cities in the UK. In terms of pollution, I don't think we stand out particularly at either end. I've yet to see a proper analysis that ranks cities, but we're certainly not as bad as some areas of London are. And we're not one of the ones at present where there is potential court action against the UK government for failing to meet mandatory European health guidelines for air quality. But that's not to say that's not necessarily because our air is any better. It's just that we're not kind of being investigated in that way.
Okay, well, if you're not a member of Friends of the Earth, shame on you. Mike, how do people come and say hello to you? Do you have meetings this time?
Yeah, we're gearing up to having a meeting. We haven't got a date fixed yet, but the best way to come and say hello to us actually will be on the 29th of November, when there'll be a big People's March for Climate, Justice and Jobs, which is happening in London, but there's a Bristol March happening as well on the 29th of November, so we'll certainly be there. You can phone me on Bristol 942 0128, and you can find us on the internet at
www.foe.co.uk.
Okay, Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of Earth, thanks very much for joining us again.
Thank you, Tony.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, Martin Summers, we're going to talk now about the strange case of Raymond Davis. Tell us a little bit about this chap, because I know we've talked about this before. We're going to hear from this professor from Pakistan talking about it. But what do you make of this whole business of the secrecy of the private military contractor?
Well, it was a very interesting case at the time. I remember his name, of course, because he was the front man for the Kinks back in the 1960s. At least that's the name that we were given. It's not even clear that this guy was called Raymond Davis. That was the name that he gave to the Pakistani authorities. But he basically shot two people who were following him, or he thought were following him. It may well be that the people who were following him were from Pakistani intelligence services.
Well, we're going to hear a bit more about
that. We'll no doubt hear maybe, about that maybe from the horse's mouth.
Yeah, maybe we should.
And the fact is that when they investigated his phone, it looked as if he was, in fact, in contact with jihadi terrorist groups inside Pakistan.
Well, it's all very well Martin Summers saying all this and me saying all this, but we speak now to Professor of International Relations at the University of Peshawar, Saeed Shaheed, all about the Raymond Davis case, which has filled up many column inches in the Pakistani press.
In Pakistan, especially after 9/11, foreigners have stopped coming over. And if any white-skinned, when I say white-skinned, I'm sorry, I'm not at all racist by saying so, but in very typical Pakistani language, if a white-skinned white man is or woman is roaming around in Pakistan, people are very keen and inquisitive about seeing that person, man and woman, and knowing about that person. So if, for example, you are traveling in a car, if you stand on a signal, traffic signal, people would really like to stare at you. Of course, it would be quite awkward for you, but this is how people behave there. And this was what had happened with Raymond Davis. But because he himself had a guilt that he was a spy and he was roaming around in Pakistan, he thought something fishy there, and he thought that some other people, like some terrorists or some other agencies people, were chasing him, and that's why he killed both of them.
So he killed two people.
He thought that he was followed. He thought probably these two people were following him, and they probably were about to kill him, but he killed them beforehand. And then, according to the eyewitnesses, he went back into his car and he brought camera. He took pictures of those dead people in the mean. But like all these things are, in fact, very typical of a spy. And then, in the meantime, he wanted to flee away from there. But the people there, they gathered around, and then there was another car which came to rescue him from American consulate in Lahore, and that car, while proceeding towards Raymond Davis, already crushed another man because of over speeding.
So he actually knocked over and killed somebody on the way to save Raymond Davis.
That's very right, yes. So therefore, three casualties took place in Pakistan in the meanwhile. Raymond Davis was caught by the Pakistani administration. It's quite interesting or unfortunate, I should say, that even the President of the United States, President Obama, also declared Raymond Davis in the beginning of crisis that he was a diplomat, whereas later on when his passport was revealed and shown to the entire world, we realized that he was not at all a diplomat, he was a contractor. And all those spies, they roam there, are normally granted this kind of a visa.
How could anybody think he was a diplomat if he'd shot two people who were unarmed and weren't actually even harming him?
Now, this is what was, in fact, the controversy between Pakistan and the United States. Pakistani administration again and again was saying that he is not at all a diplomat. He is someone, quote-unquote, a spy, whereas Americans were insisting that he was a diplomat. And the passport that he was carrying, in fact, showed it. But at that very time, they tried their level best to convince him. But later on, it was shown to the people.
Okay. What about these contractors? What's their role? I mean, obviously, he's not the only one.
That's absolutely right. Before that Raymond Davis case, many Americans had entered in Pakistan without any surveillance or without any even visa. And that was because in those days, Pakistan was ally of United States, and they wanted to give all kind of support to Americans. And in the meanwhile, as I had mentioned in the beginning, Pakistan committed a mistake. So many Americans were in Pakistan. Even Pakistani administration didn't know how many Americans are roaming around in Pakistan and how many of them were diplomats and contractors, quote unquote. But with this episode, Pakistani administration, they realized, they opened their eyes, and from that moment on, they sought the list of the people who were operating in Pakistan. Most of them who were not diplomats, they were expelled, and rest of all, the list was taken so that in future, if any such person comes, he may not be a casualty at the hands of Pakistani people.
Okay, so take up the story. We left the story with a crowd of people stopping Raymond Davis getting back to his car, and then an American car coming to rescue him. What happened next?
Before American car could reach there, the Pakistani police had caught Raymond Davis, and they took him to the police station. By the time he reached to the police station, everybody realized that two people have already been killed. The American consulate car that was Land Cruiser, it went back because they also knew that he has already been taken by police. Until then, the Pakistani agencies, they also reached, and they were taken into custody, proper custody, so that he may not be killed by the common man in police station. And later on, then the entire saga started, whether he's diplomat or he's not. Finally, as you know, beggars are not the choosers. Pakistan, which is comparatively a smaller and weaker country as compared to United States, because of the blood money provided to the victims, Raymond Davis was released, and he was taken to Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan.
So how was that justified?
Of course, there was a clause in Islamic law which is called diyat, kisasu diyat, which means that if you kill someone and the family, and you pay a particular amount, the family forgives you. It is somehow that thing was made up, but it was not in true spirit. In fact, the reason is that cold-blooded killing cannot be justified by paying money to the people. There is also a story roaming around in Lahore that family was not ready to forgive Raymond Davis. Both families, all the three families rather, the families were not ready to pay to accept money. They wanted justice to be done in this case, but because of certain pressures, quote unquote, the families were compelled to accept the money, and then the Raymond Davis was released from here.
Quite a lot came out in the weeks afterwards, not at the time, and this is the way often with these kinds of incidents, is that you get the initial news, and then the interesting bits that come out then get forgotten about in the international news.
Absolutely right. He was having a satellite telephone, Thuraya, in which he was having certain telephone numbers, which were in fact the numbers of the banned organizations, which means he was in contact, and then most of those organizations were operating in Afghanistan. So that had also made Pakistanis quite fearful of Raymond. They realized that he indeed is a spy, because he was contacting such organizations. This made things quite worse, and that was the reason that to the level of the President of the United States, it was defended that Raymond Davis was a diplomat, whereas he was not.
Was there ever any clue as to what he was doing with these various terrorist organizations?
Talk of the town is that he was contacting them against Pakistan somehow while remaining in Pakistan. That was something which was quite worrisome for us.
That was Professor of International Relations at the University of Peshawar, Saeed Shaheed. Now, Martin, at the same time, this is we're talking about now. When was it? It was February 2011, the Ray Davis scandal. At the same time, the Telegraph put out an article saying Raymond Davis was acting head of the CIA in Pakistan, and also saying that he was working for XE or Blackwater. Relatives of the victims say Davis deserves no pardon. We knew from day one he was working for the CIA and Blackwater, he said, the one of the brothers of one of those that Raymond Davis killed.
Well, I think the most interesting thing from the wider perspective is who he was in contact with and why. And you've got various jihadi organisations which are attempting to undermine the government of Pakistan, who were probably who he was in contact with. Now, that's Taliban Pakistan. Now, most people don't realise that the Western intelligence services like the CIA have got a track record going back decades of manipulating extreme jihadi terrorism. And this is what the Pakistani military will have been worried about. There are attempts to destabilise Pakistan coming from the US because Pakistan is regarded as an ally of China. So, for example, they're going to open up a port at Gwalior on the Pakistani coast, which will give China an outlet into the Indian Ocean. These are the kind of reasons why Western powers like the United States support terrorist organisations, including Islamic terrorist organisations, in order to destabilise political opponents. And in the case of the bomb in the Hindu temple in Thailand, the local police have pointed the finger firmly at Uyghur terrorists based initially in the Chinese Xinjiang province. And that's where the finger is pointing at the minute. And they have intimate relations with Western intelligence services. So the idea that our intelligence services, MI6 and CIA, are there to protect us from jihadi terrorism is simply wrong. They have a track record of working with jihadi terrorists in order to destabilise governments with whom they have disagreements or problems.
So he was freed in March, you know, about a month. Yeah, he did less than a month in jail for killing two people and for supplying weapons to the enemies of Pakistan and the enemies of the United States.
Well, we don't know exactly what he was up to, because presumably that's the whole point of having him spirited out of the country and not put on trial, is that all of that doesn't come out. But no doubt the ISI, the Pakistani intelligence services, will have had a pretty good idea of what he was up to from looking at his phone records. But what the take home for people listening to this show is, don't presume when a bomb goes off in, say, Thailand, that you know what's going on. And even if it's claimed by an Islamist group, don't presume that groups like the CIA aren't involved.
But this makes a mockery of all the laws to do with terrorism when somebody who's involved with these terrorist organisations is just let off like this.
Well, it does, doesn't it? And the answer, of course, is to actually have the law enforced. And in an ideal world, he would have gone on trial in Pakistan and all the evidence that linked him to terrorists in Pakistan would have come out. And at that point, you can then use the international media to start educating the population in the West that most of the so-called Islamic terrorism, which we're told to be absolutely terrified of and they're going to kill us in our beds, is in fact being indirectly supported and orchestrated by Western intelligence services. Not all of it, but most of it, and most of the serious stuff.
We are Bristol's first community radio station. BCFM 93.2.
Now, 17,000 victims of terrorism in Iran since the 1979 revolution. We hear now from the wife of one of them this evening. Her physicist professor husband was killed 5 years ago on his morning drive to work by a bomb detonated by remote control just as the car was passing. Before we hear actually from Mansoure Karami, this physics professor's wife, Martin, this whole business of terrorism in Iran is hardly known about. In 1981, the president and the entire cabinet were blown up by the Americans. Why?
Because they were interfering with the geopolitical goals of the oligarchy that runs the United States of America. And terrorism, I'm afraid, around the world is as American as apple pie and as British as, I don't know, a cup of tea. That's what's been going on for years. For those in the countries concerned know far more about it than the idiotic public in the West who are fed a diet of nonsense about it. Most likely culprits here, the people who benefits, it's likely to be Mossad that carried out this attack. But then Mossad, of course, works very closely with our own intelligence services and with the Americans. And I'm quite sure the Iranians will have a fairly good idea about who was behind it. Our allies in Israel, or possibly the Americans working with them.
Well, let's hear now from Mansoure Karami.
من منصوره کرمی هستم She's Mansoori Karami, and her husband was a Tehran's University professor, and his major was physics. And on 12 January 2010, when he wanted her husband wanted to go to his university, he was killed by a bomb by two motorcycle. That days, her husband woke up like other days, and after praying and eating his breakfast, he went to his room and noted some of his work that he wanted to do. Her husband, Mr. Ali Mohammadi, put his dinner to the car and say goodbye to her. And after that, he walked on his yard for a minute. And after that, he went. And I think 1 or 2 minutes later, she heard a bomb. When she heard the sound of the bomb, she couldn't believe that. This sound was related to the bomb, and she thought that it was an earthquake. All of the glasses broke. Mrs. Ali Mohammadi and her daughter, after that, they ran to her husband's car, and they saw some smoke. They saw that his husband was not in the car. He was out of the car. Husband not dead, and he is alive. And she called her, but her husband doesn't answer. And after that, she take her husband's head on her arm, and suddenly she saw that the bomb hit her husband's head. I think that this happened because of the America or Israel or Mossad's activity, because they know her husband's activity, her husband's job. Mossad, America, and Israel wanted to have some information about her husband until 2006. This incident was because of America's and Israel's and Mossad's Mossad's activity, because of some records and some documents. And the boy who arrested after this incident, he said that he had some collaboration with ISI and MI6 and Mossad. After she lost her husband, she tried to control her family. She said that in Iran we faced with a different condition. And after, for example, a family, when one family lose the father of the family or a person who supported that family, the survivor try to have their before a relationship. And after that, she talked about the power of the bomb, and that bomb have a special power. He could kill 300 people, but on that time nobody were on the LA, nobody else was killed, but all of the LA was full of the broken glasses. This bomb was put on the boxes, and these boxes on the motorcycle, and the motorcycle was behind the car. And those who wanted to explode this bomb control this bomb by the remote control. کشته نشد ولی تقریبا دو تا کامیون شیشه فقط از توی کوچه بردن و خیلی از خونه ها صدمات زیادی خوردن.
That's Mansoori Karami there, the wife of Iranian nuclear physicist who was at the university. Martin, it's just one of 17,000 victims of terrorism. The justification, apparently, I mean, we were saying there, we heard about the Pakistani ISI, the Israeli Mossad, and the British MI6. How would they justify such a killing?
Well, they didn't mention the Pakistani ISI in relation to this killing.
Yeah, she did. She did. She said ISI, Mossad, and MI6.
I thought she said CIA.
She said that at the start, but then she said that the boy who was arrested afterwards linked it to those three groups.
Well, I mean, that would make sense, because there have been attempts to destabilise the government of revolutionary government of Iran since 1979, precisely by those kind of forces. You know, if the ISI were involved, that's because they were themselves a proxy force for the CIA and MI6 in the war in Afghanistan in the 1980s. Although the problem with working with the Americans or the Israelis or the British is that they're absolutely untrustworthy. And if you were to work, if you work with them and presume that they're going to be helpful to you and they're going to be on your side, you're a fool, because they don't have any loyalty to anybody other than themselves.
Well, the only way of really looking out for what's going on with these intelligence services, MI6 for example, is this Intelligence and Security Committee, which has now just formed again. Interestingly, it's been left till just before Jeremy Corbyn was elected Labour leader, before it was formed. So it was the previous acting leader, Harriet Harman, who's appointed her favourite people to the Intelligence and Security Committee. Do you think that's significant?
Well, I think the elements within the British security services have made it clear that they're very unhappy with Corbyn. They don't trust him. They don't want to show him intelligence. I'm not surprised, because what ultimately needs to happen is a democratic government in Britain, a democratic government in the US, needs to clean out this nest of vipers. And that will probably involve sending people to prison for very long terms. If they've been involved in terrorism, I don't believe in the death penalty. In the US, they may have to use the death penalty. I believe they should be sent to prison, just like Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who orchestrated the British Army's terror campaign in Northern Ireland, killed hundreds of people. He should be in prison. He isn't. He's on a British pension.
Well, you mentioned the army mutiny there, Martin, but that was also featured in the Crispin Blunt interview on Hard Talk earlier this week, one of the best bits of interviewing I've seen for a long time from the BBC. So let's have a listen now to Crispin Blunt's take, being interviewed by Stephen Sacker on the BBC, on the army mutiny and whether to share intelligence with Mr. Corbyn.
It sounds as though there was a very inappropriate opinion reported of a serving general, as I understand.
A serving general in the Sunday Times, who said that if Corbyn were elected Prime Minister, his words, the British military would take direct action. There would be mass resignations at all levels. You would face the very real prospect of an event which would, in effect, be a mutiny.
Well, he can speak for himself, but he's certainly speaking way outside the authority of any serving officer. It would be disgraceful if that occurred. If frankly, God help us, Jeremy Corbyn is elected Prime Minister under a Labour government, the army, like everybody else, will have to turn to the right and carry out the instructions of the elected government.
But it's confusing for the British public, because your party,
as long as those instructions are lawful.
Yes, well, it's confusing for the public because your party, as soon as Corbyn was elected, issued propaganda, if I may call it that, suggesting that he was a fundamental threat to the security of the United Kingdom.
Well, he is.
Do you believe that or not?
If you believe in a coherent defence strategy for the United Kingdom, where you want 2% of at least 2% of your GDP spent on defence.
If
you want the United Kingdom to be properly committed to NATO, then I think he is a threat to our security. He would unpick the whole of our defence posture if he was allowed to revert to the opinions he expressed before he became leader of the Labour Party. There is obviously now a very live debate within the Labour Party and within the people he's appointed to his own shadow cabinet about policies around all sorts of aspects of defence and security.
Sure, but there is something different about saying that he is a fundamental risk to the core security of the nation. There's a very active debate now about whether Cameron's government is prepared to share with Jeremy Corbyn the level of military and intelligence information, secret information, that has been shared in the past.
Yes, but they're under no obligation to share that information.
No, but precedent suggests they will. And actually, it's a part of accountability and transparency in a democracy that the leader of the opposition knows as much as can be safely given to him about what is happening in the name of the United Kingdom.
No, it's not, I don't think. I don't think it's part of any... It may have become convention, but I wouldn't present it in those terms.
You don't see it as part of democracy and transparency and accountability?
No, that the leader of the opposition gets privileged access to information on the basis that other members of parliament don't have? No, not necessarily. That's a judgment for the government to take. It's normally taken when the government is seeking to persuade the leader of the opposition to associate himself with a particular government strategy in the seek of achieving, whilst the government is seeking consensus. If the government is plainly not going to get consensus from the leader of the opposition because he holds very strong views opposed to the use of military force in almost any circumstance.
And you think that's justification for giving him less access to information than previous leaders of oppositions in the recent past have enjoyed?
Well, what would be the point of giving him the information if it was not an attempt to achieve consensus?
All right.
Stephen Sacker on the BBC Hard Talk there, talking to Crispin Blunt, Conservative MP and Chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. Interesting use of the word consensus, Martin.
Well, I mean, what we've got is a consensus about foreign affairs, which is basically cooked up in elite circles. And most ordinary people, in fact, have very little understanding of foreign affairs, and they trust those with more knowledge, as it were, to make decisions for them. But I think, in actual fact, if we come back to this general and his remarks, I should say that should be a sackable offence. If you are a serving officer in the British Army and you come out with remark like that, it makes Nick Gargan look positively benign. That man should lose his job and lose his pension. And Ben Griffin, the former SAS guy who's been on this programme, said, don't say we can't find out who he is. GCHQ know exactly who he is. We can point the finger at him and get him sacked tomorrow.
Well, GCHQ haven't been doing their job either, have they? Tom Windsor, to give his view on Nick Gargan case this week. Well, that's been kicked into the long grass, so this is being stretched out even longer. Come on, Sue Mount Stevens, get your act together. And we'll have more on that one next week, no doubt. Anyway, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News. At 7 on our sister show Dialect here at BCFM next Tuesday at noon, you can hear an interview with child sex abuse survivor now on the People's Tribunal, Gemma Fox. Thanks to our guest Steve Comer and also to Mike Birkin from Friends of the Earth and old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. We're online at thisweek.org.uk, takes you straight to the show's links and archives. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us on the Politics Show at 5 next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
It's an award-winning community radio station for Bristol.